This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. There are a number of new names, or maybe even some new faces, showing up in the politics here in Northwest Indiana and in Lake County in particular in the last election. And a lot of these young people, and some are old people, but many are young people who are interested in getting involved in public office. We'll find out more about this new crop of candidates who are going to be up on the ballot for the November general election. Jim Weiser is the Lake County Democratic Party chairman, and he joins us. Jim, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you, Chris. Looking forward to it.
Now, I understand this is all of, I guess, the effort that the Lake County Democratic Party has been making in recent months to try to recruit new candidates to be on public office. Is there any reason, obviously, just to maybe just have more people on the ballot, that we're finding more people that are coming in interested in running for public office?
Well, I think, Chris, I think it's a combination of a couple of things. We made a concerted effort in 2018, first of all, to start out with our organization and try to encourage younger people to get involved by becoming possibly precinct committeemen or vice committeemen and getting involved with the party. So that's kind of where it began. And then we started also to try to recruit candidates. And we discovered that in 2018 there seemed to be a lot of interest. I'm sure it's sparked by what's occurring nationally, a lot of interest. And we ended up just by our recruiting efforts and by networking, getting candidates to run for office like you said, there's younger people, there's new faces. That we got Chris Chung, who ran in the 15th district and beat an incumbent that folks said couldn't be beat when he beat Hal Slager. We recruited Lisa Beck, who's done an outstanding job as a legislator who won her district over Julie Olthoff. We recruited Reagan Hatcher to run for state representative. Of course, Eddie Melton has been there for a while, but it was an effort to get people more engaged and younger people and new people committed to the Democratic ideals and principles. And it's, so far as you can tell, it's been working really well.
Go through the list of communities that you and your colleagues with the Lake County Democratic Party have been asking people to become members of the electorate and in turn becoming public officials if they get elected. Go through the communities to tell us about some of the people that have decided to get on the ballot in the cities and towns around the area.
Sure, I'm happy to do that, Chris. I'll kind of start on the northwest side and work my way east.
Okay.
In Hammond, you may note that two new folks, Barry Tyler and Katrina Alexander, both won primaries over long-term incumbents and did it by grassroots, I mean, totally grassroots organizations. Both of them are very young people, both of them very engaged in their community. They're going to be, I think, great additions to the Hammond City Council. In Gary, for example, we have two more people, Ty Atkins, a young lady who ran. Now, that was an open seat because Carolyn Rogers didn't run for re-election in the 4th District. But there were, my recollection is, five or six candidates, and Ty came out successful. Young lady, 32 years old, Gary Westside graduate. I played college basketball. She's just a very smart, dynamic young lady. Then Bill Godwin, who won in the 1st District in Gary, another bright young face. Then over in Lake Station, Bill Carroll, who won for won the primary for mayor, again, another open seat, is a young man, young businessman, and was recruited because he was just interested in his community. He owns a business in the community. It's successful. He wants to keep it that way, and he wants to do what's well. Then kind of moving back over in Munster, we recruited a young lady who's running for clerk treasurer, and her name's Jennifer Pizzuto Dean. And she's a very bright young lady, a Munster resident virtually her whole life, and again, someone who wanted to get active and got very involved having talked to her numerous times, very involved in national concerns about national politics. She wanted to translate it into local have a local impact. In Highland, we just caucused in to replace Dan Vassar, who decided after a very successful term as a councilman that he wanted to spend more time with his family and pursue other interests. We caucused in a young man named Martin Del Rio, 32 years old, a veteran, works in Veterans Affairs, as a matter of fact, bright young guy who I think is just going to fit in really well, and that's something that's near and dear to my heart since I spent two terms on the Highland Town Council in my former life. I'm really pleased about Martin being involved. We have out in Crown Point, now I'm jumping around a little, a young man, Zach Bryan, 28 years old, born and raised in the community, Andrean grad's got an MBA, and he's the general manager of Crown Brewing, which is the family-owned his family-owned business. Here in Schererville, for example, we have two new faces and relatively young faces, too. Vanessa Welty running in the 5th Council District and Robin Arvanitis running in, I think that's the 3rd District. Believe me, Chris, it hasn't been that difficult recruiting these folks. When you get out there and you let them know that you want, we always start out with the premise that this is for your community. Mm-hmm. This isn't necessarily, although we like it to be for the Democratic Party, but this is a way to give back to your community and to do for your community. And we knew people that have volunteered, people that were involved in their community, so we went out and recruited them, and fortunately have been very, very successful.
Are they finding that in most cases that these are people that are very well aware of the fact that they're going to have to work hard to go out there and campaign, maybe? There may be, luckily, in communities where there are Democratic majorities, but they may be in some places where there are still a lot of Republicans that are still in office, and they're going to have to go out there and convince people that they're willing to take the job and they're worthy of taking the job.
Well, that's a great point, Chris. We don't give them any false illusions. We don't go out there and tell them, you know, that it's going to be a walk in the park. We let them know that it's challenging in any community, and particularly in those communities, for example, where Zach Bryan's running, where it's, I don't even think that Crown Point's ever had a majority Democratic council. I don't believe they have. So, and he's running at large. And he knows the challenges ahead. I spent not only myself, but others spent many hours talking to Zach about what it would take. And what I've always said, Chris, and I point this out to people that ask me often about Chris Chung. Well, you know, how does a 26-year-old young man who's never been involved in government or politics, how does that happen? And it's always my premise that the first and foremost thing is you've got to have a committed candidate. You've got to have a candidate that I say has the fire burning in the belly. That's what you have to determine. It can't be something where someone says, geez, you know, if you don't have anybody else, maybe I'll think about doing it or I might do it. No, that isn't what works. What works is somebody that says, I want to do this. I have a desire to do this. I have a plan to do this. This is what I think. That's what's needed, and those are the kind of people. Those are the kind of folks we've got running now, and that's why I feel so good about it, because they're in it for the right reasons. They're in it because they want to do it. They're in it because they want to serve their communities. They don't hold any illusions about that it's going to be a cakewalk or anything. They know, and they have been since the primary, all working very, very hard.
Are there any spots left on the ballot in any of the communities coming up here that will have to be filled before the deadline?
No, actually the deadline occurred.
Okay, so it has passed. So everybody's on the ballot that's going to be on the ballot, and I suppose
correct.
It's time to get the ballots together and ready to go. When they are facing some formidable opponents in communities, as we say, the communities will say that have a number of Republicans on the ballot, or if they're just going out there and having to really, really work hard to become members of the council or commissioners, and not commissioners necessarily, but council certainly, to be sure, since we're talking city and town elections this time around, are there any opportunities that they're out there for people that maybe are just kind of thinking about whether they really want to run for office? They can kind of get experience in working as members of the polls or any place like that?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, Chris, we've set up a program, and I'm meeting with a number of the folks next Wednesday, Wednesday the 10th, kind of like an organizational meeting, and we've come up with an idea kind of sort of put together by Chris Chung and myself, and along with the help of the my precinct organization and our officers, to put together sort of an internship program. And we've got a number of young people that are seniors in high school, freshmen in college, young folks that want to work and get involved in government and in politics. So what we said is, well, here's another way you can do it. There's no precinct positions, or at least there's not a race for precinct positions now. So, but here's what you can do. Get involved in a campaign. Get involved in helping out candidates and in helping out our organization. And so we've got a number of people we've recruited in that regard. We're going to have the meeting here at my office next Wednesday to get them started, and we're going to assign them throughout the county to help out certain candidates and certain campaigns that where we think that the Democrats have a very good chance of winning or preserving seats, particularly, for example, Crown Point, also in Lowell, where I think we have a really good chance of winning a majority of councilmen in Lowell. So in those areas where traditionally Democrats have had the Democratic Party has struggled a bit in the past, we don't think we're going to struggle anymore. We think that we relate to what people believe. We get people out there working, going door to door, and going to events and going to functions and letting them know who these candidates are and why they want to serve their community. So, yes, there's plenty of opportunity for other people to get involved.
What do some of the incumbents, their Democrats, think about these people that are coming up in the ranks and, as you say, becoming going to be, I guess, in a way, assistants, certainly to the candidates that are out there? What do the old-timers or the old hands seem to think about the idea of bringing a younger, more inexperienced but anxious and very, very willing people and want to become public office?
That's interesting. There's always that that dynamic there. And that sort of not necessarily conflict, but there is that kind of push and shove there between those that have been in office or those that have been in politics for quite some time and those that haven't. But I mean, look at myself, Chris. I'm not a spring chicken here. I've done this a long time. I'm absolutely convinced that more than ever, there's a in the Democratic Party as a whole, nationally and statewide, we have a generation gap. And those of us of the generation that for a long time were at the top of the heap and were controlling things just need to recognize that it's a new day. And I don't mean necessarily a wholesale change, because there's a whole lot to be said for institutional knowledge and experience. Don't get me wrong. We've got great, I think right now, people bridging the generational gaps who are good public officials, take our sheriff, Oscar Martinez, or take our county commissioner, Mike Repay. I mean, folks like that who are not on the super young side, but yet bridge that gap and have shown and demonstrate to these younger folks how people can serve the community and can serve Northwest Indiana. But what we've done is I think we've kind of eased into it a little bit, and we've had a lot of discussion about it and a lot of meetings over it. And those old-timers, as you say, understand that there's a new generation coming along, and as long as we get good, qualified young people, and they see that these folks are there for the right reasons and the right intentions and have a lot of energy to offer, they know that it, in the long run, it helps all of us. So it hasn't been as difficult to start working on that change as, quite frankly, I thought it was going to be.
That's good news. That's good news. We'll look forward to seeing these new candidates out on the campaign trail in the communities around Lake County, looking for votes, looking for supporters. And we appreciate you sitting down and talking over some of this information with them, as well as offering this information to us to give us some insight as to what these new candidates are really like and how interested they really seem to be in wanting to become public office. And we hope to we'll see what happens, of course, in the November election. But we hope that many succeed.
Well, thank you, Chris. It was great talking to you, and happy to do it anytime.
Thanks, Jim. Jim Weiser is Lake County Democratic Party Chairman. You're listening to Regionally Speaking. Grace Beyond Borders Northwest Indiana is an organization with a mission to offer hope, love, and care to the invisible homeless population here in Northwest Indiana. And on Saturday, August 3rd, they will host their second annual Face of Grace Walkathon to raise funds to continue the work of affecting the lives of those who are struggling with homelessness, hopelessness, and drug addiction. Lakeshore Public Radio's Dee Dotson recently spoke with Marcus Martin, who is the founder of the organization.
When you think about homelessness, oftentimes we think of it being a concern in major cities like our neighbors to the north. Your organization is shedding light on the surprisingly high number of homeless Hoosiers in the region. Tell us about Grace Beyond Borders.
Thank you. Thank you, Dee, for allowing me to be able to share with you and the listeners of the radio here. Grace Beyond Borders is in their seventh year of operation, working with our homeless population and those who are struggling with addictions. So we provide a lot of services to individuals. We conduct weekly street outreaches to go out on the streets to identify and offer services to those who are out there in hopeless situations. We have community-wide events, addiction recovery classes. We serve breakfast two times a week. We would like to do seven, and we hope to expand one day. Also, we coordinate with collaborative partners to provide transportation, meals, clothing, emergency shelter.
So tell me something. Is homelessness really an issue in the region?
Well, through 6 years of research, what we discovered was what we call an invisible homeless population. Invisible in two ways. People oftentimes turn their head away from even observing what they see may be homeless. So by ignoring it, they continue to walk and pretend it's not there. Two, individuals will sleep not necessarily on the streets, but in a number of different locations, including abandoned garages, vacant apartments, in their own personal vehicles, or the biggest one is they will go from house to house. I even had a campaign last year, A Night Without a Home, to reveal over 30 locations where people were sleeping overnight. And I actually stayed overnight in those different locations and talked about each individual that I knew slept in those locations. Resources to operate and serve the clients.
I recently read some sobering statistics on your website. It listed, among other things, that a homeless person walks an average of 10,000 steps or 5 miles daily. That is astounding. Now, is that the inspiration behind the Face of Grace Walkathon?
Yes, that's one of them, because one of the issues with individuals who are out here struggling, I'll give you an example. Walking from East Chicago to Hammond to the Social Security Administration office is a little bit over 3 miles one way. So coming back, that's another 3 miles. Now, some individuals are able to have some means of transportation, but some of them do not. So that's just one example of, now I need these services. How do I get there? Okay, I have to walk. That's 6 miles. Now, that's 12,000 steps. There are no centralized services. There are very few centralized services, I should say. So If I need a birth certificate, where do I go? How many buses do I need to catch, or how far do I need to walk? There's individuals who are walking. We see individuals walking, but then we ignore them. We may feel it's not safe.
Now, Marcus, I would have to agree with the point on safety being a key concern as to why many of us don't stop if we see someone walking. Many of us are torn. On the one hand, human decency commands us to help our neighbors, but on the other hand, fear is what keeps us, especially women who may be alone, from stopping.
And it's understandable. There's a lot of homeless traffic that actually walks between East Chicago and Gary on the Michigan Avenue, coming through East Chicago and Hammond, Michigan Avenue, going to Fifth Avenue. A lot of people walking through there. And sometimes if you have a job, you need to get to your job, and your job is not in the city that you are homeless in, then you have to walk. And that's what's going on. A lot of people, it's just not enough employment opportunities and services that individuals who are in a homeless situation, and they need some type of help to get out of it. So they have to walk to those, you know, to get those services until they can accumulate enough dollars to be able to. But then again, that's not transportation to all locations. There's not enough bus services going on. So you end up having to walk. So the walkathon is just simply inviting people to just do 2,000 steps. They come out on the day, August 3rd, when we have the event scheduled, the Place of Grace Walkathon, over to the Boys and Girls Club in Gary. And we'll be walking around the Boys and Girls Club in the Towson Park area. And that's going to be 2,000 steps. And they can walk as many times as they would like. But also, for those individuals who live in other cities or just simply who want to support but cannot be present on that day, they can walk. They can do 2,000 steps wherever they are. They can get on a treadmill and walk 2,000 steps. They can walk in the local park near their home or in their city. And that's going to be so they can still be involved. They can still donate. They can still help that other individual. But the dollars we raise will be going toward operating our first emergency overnight and transitional facility that hopefully will be opening up this year. And the second one, which we will have a goal of opening up the end of this year or early part of next year. So these are our goals. We know we have to have the dollars to operate, but also to bring some stability to individuals so that we can have contact with them on a daily basis to make sure that they're getting the services that they need.
Now, Marcus, before I let you go, for those that may be listening right now that would like to make a donation, how can they get in contact with Grace Beyond Borders?
We're encouraging, again, the virtual walkers. That's one way, and they can donate. And wherever they are located in this country or whatever city they're in, they can certainly donate in that type of way and do their virtual walk wherever they are. And we're inviting community sponsors out, information tables at the walkathon, and $100, and come out, and they can be community sponsors. And they want to do a little bit more and have some recognition for the organization at their event. They can be a bronze sponsor, and we go all the way up to a platinum sponsor, which is higher on the sponsorship levels. But again, we just want to open up that door of opportunity, and we can get more information and to them if they dial in at 219-712-5192.
That's Lakeshore Public Radio's Dee Dotson speaking with Grace Beyond Borders founder Marcus Martin. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. A Purdue University Northwest professor in the Hammond campus has put out a new book that is one of interest that if you happen to remember when Mitch Daniels was the governor of Indiana, how he was involved in this. And Professor David Detmer is with us to talk about his book, which is now out to be checked out. And Professor Detmer, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, tell us a little bit about, tell us, if you will, about the title of the book, Xenophobia, The Battle Over History and Education, Politics, and Scholarship. And how does that happen to bring a person named Howard Zinn together with Mitch Daniels?
Okay. The way this happened, back in 2013, there was a reporter for the Associated Press who did a Freedom of Information Act search of the emails of Mitch Daniels from when he had been governor. And he came upon an email that Mitch Daniels put out when Howard Zinn died. And for people who are not familiar with Howard Zinn, he was a historian who wrote a best-selling book called A People's History of the United States. Mm-hmm. And basically, in Mitch Daniels' email, he said, "I think that's a terrible book. I don't think it should be used for credit anywhere in the state of Indiana. In fact, I'm going to quote directly. I'm looking at the email right now."
Okay.
He said, "Can someone assure me that it is not in use anywhere in Indiana? If it is, how do we get rid of it before more young people are force-fed a totally false version of our history?" And so I got interested in this, and I started researching it. And one of the things Mitch Daniels did to justify his action was to say, "Well, you don't have to take my word for it that Howard Zinn was a bad historian who wrote a bad book. There are a number of historians and other scholars who say the same." And so I started reading and researching their work, and I found that it was just larded with errors. They would misquote Zinn. They would say, "Well, he never says X when he really does say X." Just lots and lots of mistakes. And so the title of the book is just a pun on his name. Xenophobia with an X is, you know, fear of foreigners, essentially. And so I then took Zinn's name, Xenophobia, to reflect the attitude of Mitch Daniels and these other scholars. And there was this sort of battle over this particular book.
What did people seem to feel was wrong, and in particular, I guess, Mitch Daniels, about Howard Zinn's book, The People's History of the United States?
Yeah, what was different about Zinn's book is traditional American history books tend to very much glorify the deeds of our presidents and military leaders and business leaders. And I think from Zinn's point of view, they had something of a patriotic bias, you might say, not willing to fully confront the bad side of our history. And so in Zinn's work, it's called A People's History, and I guess there are really sort of two sides to that. One is wanting to acknowledge the suffering sometimes that the ordinary people had endured at the hands of these leaders. That's number one. And then number two, the book makes an argument that significant progress has tended to be initiated from below by the people rather than from the top by presidents and so on. But back to the first point, just to give an illustration, the first chapter of Zinn's book is about Columbus, and he quotes from Columbus's journal. Now, I don't have this right in front of me, so I'm paraphrasing,
No. But
in Columbus's journal, he says things like the Arawak people that he had met. He says, "Oh, they're handsome people, they're friendly, they're generous, they're eager to share everything they have. With 50 men, we could subjugate the whole lot of them and enslave the entire island." And in Zinn's account, it proceeds to talk about how Columbus enslaved Indians and killed many of them who didn't give him enough gold and so on. And people like Mitch Daniels are offended by that. They see it as anti-American. So I think that's sort of the main criticism that people have had of Zinn's work.
Has it been the case where, as you say, it's just one person's opinion, or maybe a group of people's opinion against Howard Zinn and then the way that he put that book together?
Oh, yes, Mitch Daniels is far from alone. So I think it's fair to say that many people who identify with the conservative wing of American political opinion, they tend to prefer a more quote-unquote patriotic approach to history, so they tend not to like it. And then among professional historians, it's a little bit different. And one of the things that Mitch Daniels said in defending himself is he said, "Hey, it's not just people on the right, conservatives, who have criticized Zinn. There are people of other political persuasions who have done so as well." And he's right about that. And I think their part of the explanation is not so much political conservatism as professional conservatism. And what I mean by that is historians have been trained. There's a certain way to do history. There are certain subjects you tend to emphasize and other things you de-emphasize. And Zinn was doing it differently than, you know, the role models they learned when they were in graduate school. So it sort of looked wrong. It looked as if Zinn had an axe to grind. And so I think that's part of why they criticized it. But I do want to emphasize that although Zinn has many critics, he also has a great many admirers, including among professional historians. He's gotten a lot of praise from some historians and won some awards and things of that nature. And that book is a phenomenal publishing success. It sold over 2 million copies, and that's very rare for a history book.
In fact, you mentioned one of his greatest supporters, and there's a quote that's in the book here from author Noam Chomsky. He's an amazing person in his own right, too.
Yes, he is. Noam Chomsky, for people not familiar with him, he's a linguist from MIT and often considered to be the most important figure in that discipline in history. He really revolutionized the discipline. And he's also, you might say, a polymath, someone who's made important contributions to many fields. My field, incidentally, is philosophy. I'm a professor of philosophy, and Chomsky is very highly regarded among philosophers. He's done very important work in that field. He's done important work in mathematics, computer science. He's quite an amazing figure.
We're talking with David Detmer. He's a professor of philosophy, as you just mentioned, at Purdue University Northwest in Hammond. He's been on the faculty there at the Hammond campus since 1989, and he has just written another book, and this one is entitled Xenophobia, The Battle Over History and Education, Politics, and Scholarship. What's interesting is that you mentioned then-governor, now former governor, and now Purdue University president, Mitch Daniels. At the time that he was governor, he was very much against Zinn's book, and I guess made some very concerted efforts to be sure that it was banned in Hoosier schools, I understand.
That is correct. And so, those emails, as I mentioned, have been published, and he did instruct his subordinates to look into this. And what he ended up, there was a kind of back and forth with his subordinates, and they ended up saying, we should do, I'm looking at it right now, we should undertake a review of university courses across the state. This would, quote, force to daylight a lot of excrement. And then Daniels replied, go for it, disqualify propaganda. So they had this whole exchange where they talked about trying to in some way make sure the book was not being used for credit. Now, as it turns out, once this was exposed, I think Mitch Daniels was a bit embarrassed because most of the national publicity was negative. Their thought was, you know, this is censorship. It's not really appropriate for a governor to be interfering with educational decisions about which books are being used. And so here's an interesting thing about it. He then claimed that the articles in the press had misrepresented his emails. He said, I wasn't talking about the university. I was only talking about K through 12 education. Yes, at the university, professors can teach anything they want. But when you look at the actual emails, it's hard to sustain that interpretation because he starts out, he quotes from an obituary that says that Zinn's book is, quote, the textbook of choice in high schools and colleges around the country. And then Daniel says, can someone assure me that it is not in use anywhere in Indiana? He doesn't say anything about, you know, K through 12 as opposed to the university. And then when one of his subordinates comes back and says, well, I've gone online and I've found that it's being used in a course at Indiana University, then Daniel says, well, we can't have that. We've got to disqualify that. So it appears that his claim that he was only talking about K through 12 is not true. The actual emails do not sustain that interpretation.
Now you go now to 2018. We have former Governor Mitch Daniels, now the president of Purdue University. What's, as far as we know, his current thinking about Mr. Howard Zinn and about his book, People's History of the United States?
I don't think he has commented on it in recent years. Mm-hmm. When the controversy came out, as I say, he tried to make this claim he was not talking about the university. So he said things like, if anybody at Purdue wants to teach Howard Zinn, I won't interfere with it. And if Howard Zinn were a faculty member at Purdue, I would let him pursue his research without interfering with him, and so on. So he said all of those things when this whole story was exposed. But to my knowledge, he hasn't really addressed the controversy since then. There was, at that time, there were some professors at the West Lafayette campus who wrote an open letter to more or less protest what Daniels had done, and he wrote a kind of reply to that, and in that reply he made some of these points I've mentioned, claiming he wasn't talking about the university. But to my knowledge, he hasn't commented on Howard Zinn since then.
Well, I'm sure he'll probably want to see a copy of your book. He probably should take a look at it. Maybe Mr. Daniels won't.
Maybe. Who knows? I'm not sure what his reading habits are, but yeah.
Maybe Mr. Daniels won't, because he's already gone through that phase of his life, and he probably doesn't want to live that again, I would imagine so.
That's quite possible.
Professor David Detmer of the Purdue University Northwest Campus in Hammond is a professor of philosophy, and he's also the author of another book. He's written four other books before, but his latest book is entitled Xenophobia, The Battle Over History and Education, Politics, and Scholarship. And also, too, by the way, he serves as the current chairman of the Purdue University Northwest Faculty Senate. And Professor Detmer, thank you very much for being with us to talk about your book. And hope that a lot of people do manage to get a copy of it. If they have not known about how Howard Zinn, learned something about the man, about his philosophy, and why it seemed to raise so many hairs on the back of Mitch Daniels' neck, apparently, when he learned about it the first time it came around. Thank you for being with us to talk about it today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Purdue University English Literature Professor Carolyn Boyarsky also spoke with us late last year about her latest book on the effects of good and bad communication. We bring back her remarks and the example she mentions in the book. And here's our conversation, beginning with a good example, how Enbridge Energy had worked with residents in the town of Griffith as they planned out a pipeline expansion project.
They were also, in doing this, there would also be a lot of trucks, a lot of traffic in the area. They needed to reassure the community of Griffith and those people who lived right around where they were located that this was safe. And people were already coming from an idea of having heard about that Kankakee leak. So they put together a slide presentation in which they really were able to present what they were doing and that how all of the safety features that they were putting in would work. And they explained it in a way that anyone could understand. And then they went around to a lot of the organizations in the region and talked about what they were doing. It's not easy, and there will always be people who will complain, but I think their presentation was one of the best I've seen in attempting to assure a community that they were taking all precautions that they could.
We're talking with Purdue University Northwest English Literature Professor Carolyn Boyarsky, who has written a number of books here on communication, and in particular with business and industry, teaching people in business and industry how to better communicate, to explain to the general public in many cases what the projects are. In this particular book, we've taken up the issue of a good piece of communication with the Enbridge Pipeline Project in Indiana. And you have also some examples of miscommunication in particular in one other area in particular, and of course a nationally known bad example of miscommunication. Will you explain those, please?
Well, a very bad form of miscommunication occurred over in the Chicago flood in 1992. And I always like to talk about that because I think it is absolutely the perfect model of miscommunication. It was done in a way that it could have been totally prevented if the communication had been appropriate for the people who were involved. The hole in the tunnel walls had been discovered in January. It was a company that had strung cables. And the company saw it, contacted the city of Chicago to let them know there was this hole in a wall. And then the city sent they did send someone down to take a look at it. He couldn't find a parking place, so he came back. By the time they really looked at it and got someone down there, the wall was crumbling. Well, he came back. He took a couple pictures. He came back, and they had meetings and decided they now would worked out how they would fix it. And eventually, they sent a note to the head of that department. Well, it turns out the head of that department was new. He was acting. He was in finance, not an engineer. And they had not taken any of that into account. Thought this was just another piece, like one of the potholes in Chicago. And took his time, told everybody to put out a bid for it. They did. The bid was way high, so they put out another bid. And when the bid finally, before the bid, second bid came in, the flood occurred. Had anyone taken into consideration that this man didn't know where this flood was in the financial district and the million-dollar mile and provided him with this kind of information, he might not have put it out for bid. He might have said, go ahead and take care of the problem.
That you mentioned in the book, too, it was a problem dealing with a very famous oil rig explosion, the BP Deepwater Horizon explosion that happened, and how there was a great deal of miscommunication about that. We know, of course, the outcome of that, but how did the miscommunication in that particular case come about?
That was a problem of actually taking what we do in texting and tweeting and thinking about social media and how we communicate instead of thinking this is professional. A man on the rig, one of the engineers on the rig, emailed someone on land and said, we're having a real problem. The man on the line, on land, he was the manager, mm-hmm. wrote back and said, I'm sure this is a problem, but we can take care of it tomorrow. I'm going dancing tonight.
You mentioned the Columbia space shuttle breakup in the book, too, and some miscommunication there. How did that come about?
It couldn't have been prevented, the problem, but they might have been able to get those astronauts home. There was an engineer there who recognized what the real problem was and wrote an email back to the engineers working on trying to solve the problem. If you remember, Houston would not send a photographer, and they had no idea just how big the hole was or where it was. And when this engineer sent his email, he began something like, I know you guys are busy, and I know that sometimes I go flying off with the wrong answers, but I thought you all might want to. At this point, nobody is going to bother reading further. He eventually did hit exactly what, just about what was going to happen, somewhere around the middle of the third paragraph, which is where a lot of people put information that is what is the really necessary information. I've sort of called it third paragraph syndrome. Put something in that first paragraph that will keep the reader's attention. The reader will not read further. We don't read word for word, memos, letters, correspondence. We skim or scan them.
That's Purdue University Northwest English Literature Professor Carolyn Boyarsky, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking. The Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra gets its summer full of music underway this weekend with its annual series of free outdoor concerts. And music director and conductor of the orchestra, Kirk Muspratt, with us to talk about the very first concert coming up along Cedar Lake this weekend, Saturday. Yeah. And that's a great location to have a concert, and maybe that's the reason why it always starts there. It gets the whole summer concert series kicked off for a while, doesn't it?
It does, Chris. Thank you very much for having me. It's become a tradition that we start our summer series the South Shore Summer Music Festival at Cedar Lake, and we're going to start there on July the 20th. And the next weekend, we're in Crown Point on Saturday the 27th. Once we get into August, we do both Friday and Saturday. We're at the Dunes National Park in West Beach. And on Saturday the 3rd, we're in Griffith. Then we are in the next weekend, we're in Wolf Lake in Hammond and Cherville on Friday and Saturday the 9th and 10th.
Now, also, too, that besides the regular schedule of summer concerts in all of these great, very picturesque places to have a concert, you have to, of course, shoehorn one in, I suppose, in Valparaiso. Tell us more about that and what people can look forward to there.
Yes, we have a great time in Valparaiso on August the 3rd. We always do it on a Wednesday night. Mm-hmm. It's a special night in the town, and the place is absolutely jam-packed, and it's a beautiful atmosphere. It's a fantastic venue to play in, and I know the orchestra always has a beautiful time.
Well, speaking of the orchestra, now tell us, since we've kind of set the stage as far as where the concerts are going to be this summer, tell us about the concerts. What's on the bill, so to speak, for the music this year?
Yeah, I have several themes sort of this year, Chris. Because people say they like a lot of variety in the concerts. We're going to start with just some light classical overtures and marches. And the next theme I have is I want to commemorate D-Day, because it's just happened and it's a very important 75th anniversary. And so we're going to, we have a singer named Brooklyn Snow. She's a wonderful soprano. She's going to sing White Cliffs of Dover, which is one of my favorite pieces in the world. And we're going to do some Victory at Sea. We're going to do music from Band of Brothers. And we're going to actually play Anchors Away.
I guess you can't not have some Victory at Sea music in Richard Rodgers, yeah. Or his ghost would probably haunt you for the rest of your life if you
it's
don't.
It's true. It's true. And then we're also going to celebrate the landing, the 50th anniversary of America landing a man on the moon, and we're going to play Apollo 13 and Star Trek, some Star Trek. That's the first half. We always do some Broadway music. We're going to absolutely do something for the kids. We're going to play Nimbus 2000 from Harry Potter for the kids, and then we're going to do just some John Williams for sure, Chris, because it is the 65th anniversary of John Williams writing his first music for TV or the films.
Right. What was that piece? Do you happen to remember what
no,
he worked on?
It was commercials, but he was doing Gilligan's Island and Lost in Space and things like that.
Oh,
and
I see.
And he was doing the orchestrations for some of the big guys in Hollywood at the time I can't remember the date exactly, but it'll be 65 years. And we're going to do a whole John Williams concert next year to start the season. So it's another reason to be playing John Williams.
Well, that's something also to look forward to for the 2020 Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra Concert Series coming up.
And
be
thanks
sure.
so much. That's really nice of you.
We also know, too, that with these great places where there are considered some of the best outdoor concert venues in the region and some great music of all kinds coming up for the concert, it's an opportunity for people to just go out and just relax. You always encourage folks to bring the coolers and bring the lawn chairs and the blankets and all to come out and sit out and enjoy themselves.
And bring their relatives and their children.
That's right. The more the merrier, to be sure here. So if anybody has more questions, if we've kind of glossed over some of the particulars about the locations for the summer concert series, where can folks find out more now?
Well, they just call the office, look at our website, look up South Shore Summer Music Festival, or look up Northwest Indiana Symphony online, and it'll be all sitting there right in front of you. Plus, we'll have lots of flyers out this summer.
Well, Kirk, thanks very much for being with us, and the best of luck for the entire summer concert series happening with the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra.
Thank you very much.
A number of Northwest Indiana groups, including Northwest Indiana Resist and progressive political groups, are going to hold a peaceful protest against immigration policy this Saturday morning outside the U.S. Federal Building in Hammond. The protest begins at 11 o'clock. Political activist Ruth Needleman says that they want to make sure that documented and undocumented residents know that they support them and they should be able to live in peace.
We have a lot of immigrants in our community. Many are legal. Some are
asylum seekers, and some are undocumented, but they still have rights.
Needleman says that local groups have been protesting the ICE deportation flights conducted out of the Gary Chicago International Airport almost from the beginning.
People who are deported from our airport are not criminals in the sense of they killed, robbed, stole, beat up. They are violators of civil law because they are here without proper documents.
Needleman says that this Saturday's event in Hammond is following the rally and vigil last weekend when federal immigration and customs enforcement authorities announced that they were going to begin mass raids in Chicago and other cities. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. And our thanks from conversations with Lake County Democratic Party Chairman Jim Weiser, authors Carolyn Boyarsky and David Detmer, and Lakeshore Public Radio's Dee Dotson with the feature about the upcoming walkathon to help end homelessness in the region. And we'll be back with you on Monday.